على أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين واللعن الدائم على أعدائهم أجمعين. الحمد لله, we have made it to another Fatimiyya, the doorway to Ashura. Fatimiyya is the doorway to Ashura. My condolences on these days and these nights. When we look at Islamic history, the Shia school has a few turning points in Islamic history where it puts its finger on the Shia school and emphasizes and highlights. One of them being Ashura. Now we're in Fatimiyya, but you'll see the link. One of them is Ashura. What do you get out of Ashura? What you get out of Ashura, when it's highlighted enough, is that people will understand that something was wrong. Something went wrong in history, or else the grandson of the Prophet isn't supposed to be slayed the way he was slayed. So something must have gone wrong. That's why the Ahlul Bayt, they emphasize so much throughout history to keep it alive. Because Ashura is where, is that red line where it has been crossed. Muharram is when evil comes and shows itself completely and says, I'm standing in the face of Islam. Before that, you know, it's kind of getting along with Islam, you know, the evil, you know, it's kind of in it's wearing the clothing of the haq and truth. But you know, in deep down inside there is nifaq, there is animosity towards Islam and all of that. All of this was up until Ashura. After Ashura, when Ashura happens, all of evil shows itself. Islam says here, and the Ahlul Bayt say, sorry. Till here, there was tolerance. Here onwards, we're not going to let that happen. We're not going to let evil take over completely and destroy the faith and get rid of Tawheed, get rid of Nubuwwah, get rid of Ma'ad and this Usul al-Din. We're not going to let it. But what we see is this Ashura was kept alive and everyone knows it happened. What do we get out of it? What we get out of Ashura is different. Different people will get different results. So for some, you will see that this is the best they can do. Is that they come to the conclusion that Yazid was a bad person. Yes? That's all they can get out of Ashura, which is alright, better than some other people who say, no, even Yazid wasn't wrong. Okay. Yazid was wrong. Why? Because he's a tyrannical ruler. He's an unjust ruler. Imam Hussein is the grandson of the Prophet. So he can't stand this. A ruler has to be just. Like who? Like Muawiyah. Like the Khulafa before. That's what they'll say. Yazid was unjust, so Hussein ibn Ali, the grandson of the Prophet, can't allow that to happen. Anyone else who was in his place also wouldn't let this happen. That's as far as they'll go. Then you will have some who are more blessed. They'll move back more than that. They'll say, no, Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam, he stood up because the deen and religion of his grandfather had turned into a monarchy. By who? By Muawiyah. Muawiyah made it a monarchy, hereditary. It is passed on to my son. It's something that stays within the family. Yes? That's why he stood. Imam Hussein stood up. Okay, this is better than just Yazid. But still, it's not perfect. It's not the ideal. It does get in the way of Muawiyah though. For some, that's how far they'll go. For others, it gets better. They'll say, no, no, no. What put the Khilafah in the hands of Bani Umayyah? What put power in the hands of Bani Umayyah? So that Ashura took place later. It's all because of the Khilafah going into the hands of the third Khalifa, which was of Bani Umayyah. Uthman was of Bani Umayyah. Through the second Saqifah, that six-person council and so on. I don't want to get into that history. So some people, they'll go this far. They'll say, that is where things went wrong. Others, when you sit down and speak with them, you tell them, oh, you're Shia, but you said you weren't Shia before. Why is it that you're Shia? It says, because of Ashura. You say, really? What is that? What has Ashura done for you? It has proven to me that things went wrong from the beginning. They were hiding from us. People have told me this. They were hiding from us. Ashura, just the whole event of Ashura. When we heard about it, just hearing about it showed us that something went wrong in the beginning. So it goes all the way back to there, and the problem is solved for some people. Now, I don't want to say that Ashura, the reason behind the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, was so that, you know, people can find out that everything went wrong in the beginning. Not necessarily. Our ulama have explained that the main reason is because Bani Umayyah came, took over. Evil is getting rid of Tawheed. They have to stop that. The Imam has no choice but to stand. Okay. That is one of the turning points of Islamic history. The Shia, and because of the Imams and what the Imams have prescribed, highlights this. Not only highlights it, keeps it alive through tears. And look at how strong it has remained alive, that even when some Shia scholars might question certain details of Ashura, other people get angry. Of course, I'm not saying this is the best thing, but look at how strong it has been preserved, that even if our own scholars sometimes might question some details, people stand and take arms and, you know. As I said, this is not ideal though. If a great alim has spoken, he's entitled to an opinion. A great alim, of course. But anyway, point being, the Imams have told us to keep it alive. So what do we have? A turning point called Ashura. The Imams have taught us to put our finger on it and highlight it. What do we get out of it? Two things. One, it's something that happened for sure. No one doubts. Even the Salafi Wahhabis, the ones that are takfiri, I've seen them not recite, but read off of the Maqatil. Go on YouTube, search it. Some of these famous Wahhabi sheikhs, they read off of Maqtal. They say, yes, we acknowledge that this happened and it was wrong, we're upset. Of course, it wasn't Yazid's fault, it was Umar ibn Sa'd's fault, it was Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad's fault, it's that kind of stuff, and just those justifications. But anyway, it's something that happened for sure, one. Two, results come out of it. But these results may vary. For some, it'll be different than others. Let's move on to another turning point in Islamic history. And that is Fatimiyyah. Fatimiyyah is different than Ashura. It's the actual opposite, I would say, of Ashura. Why? Because Ashura, we said, happened for sure. The results are different. But with Fatimiyyah, the problem we have is there are doubts. It is questioned and challenged. Why? Because if it is established that this actually happened, then the results will not vary. The results will only be one. Everyone will unanimously agree on the results. That's why Fatimiyyah is very important. You can't doubt things after it is established that Fatimiyyah took place. What do I mean by Fatimiyyah? Not just the climax of the story of Fatimah Zahra's martyrdom, but rather all those dark things that happened that make those days around the Prophet's death before and after, they make those days very dark. Yes, the Prophet's demise was one of the greatest masaib ever to happen. But it's not the only thing that makes those days dark. It's a lot more than that. Those things that happened a little bit before the Prophet passed away, after the Prophet passed away, all the way to the martyrdom and the passing of Fatimah Zahra and her leaving this world. When I say Fatimiyyah, that's what I mean. Some very important things have happened in these days. The results that you'll get out of it, they'll do wonders. There's no doubting, there's no problems. But the problem is that this Fatimiyyah that we believe in is not believed in by all. It is challenged. It is questioned. And of course, unfortunately, you can say unfortunately here, it's even finding its way, making its way into the Shia. That's why there's a need to kind of address these needs. What has rendered Fatimiyya not enough to prove that the Shia has something to say? When you think about it, Fatimiyya is enough. What's the cause of this happening, of Fatimiyya being in a way that it's not enough anymore? So when we're talking about this subject, there are different people that we might be addressing. Our audiences will vary. Sometimes you have the Shia. For the Shia, it's very easy, brothers and sisters. I'm not going to get into that. The Shia has enough literature that speaks of the details, that speaks of all the things that happened before the Prophet passed away, after the Prophet passed away. We have a hadith. I might narrate some in the future. There shouldn't be that much doubt for the Shia regarding this incident, because of our narrations, plus what we find in Sunni sources as well, not first-hand Sunni sources though, but reliable Sunni sources nonetheless, and putting these bits and pieces together. For the Shia, if I'm going to speak to the Shia, we shouldn't have a problem. But then you have another form of audience that you are addressing when it comes to these issues. The ones who are, for example, they want to, well, they say revert to Islam. Okay, convert to Islam or revert to Islam, whatever word you like to use. For these people who don't have an Islamic background, who are, as they say, khalid dhihn, their minds are blank regarding the companions of the Prophet's family, the Prophet appointing someone or not appointing someone. You have this type of people. And then you also have our Sunni brothers and sisters who, they are not heavily influenced by those sheikhs out there that will give them certain foundational principles and shove that down their throats in a way that they develop a lens through which that's what they see everything with. Whether it's verses of the Quran, whether it's a hadith, whether it's historical narrations and accounts in the history sources, and so on and so forth, which we will discuss in detail, inshallah, in these nights. So you have these two types. Some who have no background at all, some who might have a background, but they're moderate, you know. I don't like using that word, but I'll use it. They're moderate, they're open-minded, they're not influenced heavily. And then you have the third group, which are heavily influenced. Heavily influenced by their sheikhs. I'm not going to say they're all Wahhabis or they're all Salafis even. No, even normal Sunni brothers and sisters that we have out there, lots of times they're heavily influenced. I'll give you stories, inshallah, as we go on. These are the audiences that we might have. Who are we going to be talking to these nights? Well, we'll be talking to the Shia, but not to prove anything, but rather remove any doubts that there might be, to at least give us more confidence regarding this incident. And it will get a little deep. It will get a little academic sometimes. That's why I'll need your extra attention sometimes. Sometimes, of course, you can never give me all your attention. That's one group that we'll be addressing. And the rest, we will even be going as far to try to address those who are heavily influenced by the shuyukh. They have those principles in their minds that I'll explain what those principles are. Is there a way even to have something at least to say when it comes to people who are heavily influenced? At least have something to say. I'm not saying convince, because it's interesting. Some people are always after convincing others and making others Shia. There's a hadith. I'm not saying this is not good. I'm not saying this is a blessed initiative. But we have a hadith that tashayyu and being Shia isn't for everybody. You'll try your best, but sometimes this person just is not deserving, apparently. Whatever the reason is, I'm not saying all of them are like that. Now these are the different people that we're going to be talking to. Now someone might come and say, what's the difference between even trying to speak about who the first one was, who the fourth one was? At the end of the day, the one who was supposed to be first, according to you, became the fourth Khalifa. Yes? So what's the point of all this argument? And they'll cite the verse, تِلْكَ أُمَّةٌ قَدْ خَلَتْ لَهَا مَا كَسَبَتْ وَعَلَيْهَا مَكْتَسَبَتْ. These companions of the prophets who passed away, the people who were there when the prophet passed away, they're all dead now. It's time to move on. It's not that important because eventually the one that was supposed to be first became fourth. Why are you bothering yourself so much? The answer to that is that this is aqidah. If the aqidah is not right, the amal will not be accepted. If there's a chance that he was supposed to be first, not fourth, and I don't go into it and I don't do my research, then my amal might fall. I might be a nobody in the hereafter. Do I want that? If this wasn't an important issue, why has it been persisting for the past 1400 years? And then the arguments are renewed, hammered out, refined, answers are given, back and forth, going back and forth. Of course, it has to be peacefully. It has to be in a peaceful manner. There has to be dialogue. As a matter of fact, the reason why I've chosen this topic on the side, this is one of the byproducts, this is one of the side outcomes, inshallah, we're shooting for, or I'm shooting for, is that we can talk about these issues, but in a peaceful, respectful manner. I don't know why there's this notion out there, alhamdulillah, it's dying out now, hopefully, that to talk about these issues, you have to be provocative. You have to make sure to curse and slander and so on and so forth. If you do it like that, it shows your weakness. Yeah, we made people Shia by slandering their great symbols, their figures. Yeah, you made 10 people Shia, but you caused the death of maybe 100 somewhere else. I don't know. If it wasn't an important issue, it wouldn't have persisted for 1400 years. And there is one hadith that every Muslim agrees on. That the Prophet has said, "Man mat walaysa fi unuqihi bay'a." A person who passes away, dies, and doesn't have bay'ah of somebody on their neck. Hasn't given bay'ah to an imam. Mata mitatan jahiliya. Has died a death of ignorance, which means has died a non-Muslim. What is this hadith saying? If the one that was fourth was supposed to be the first, that means all of those who gave bay'ah to the first, there's an issue here. Till today. So we have to fix this aqidah. What do you mean? Tilka ummatun qad khalat. Oh, that those people, they've passed, and there's nothing to worry about anymore. If we are able to fix this problem, he was supposed to be first, not fourth, then we can understand that Ashura wasn't supposed to happen. It's only because that one who was supposed to be first became fourth, and out of bad luck, let's call it. He became fourth and he was the one to come after Uthman was assassinated. So now all the blame goes on him. If he was the first, the blame wouldn't go on him. And if the blame hadn't gone on him, then Muawiyah wouldn't have stood up against the Imam Ali. Then the Battle of Jamal wouldn't have taken place. And then all of this leading to Ashura, it's all connected. No, who says it's a simple subject? Yes, a Shia brother might come and say, but we have already spoken about these issues enough. We have to move on. Isn't it time to learn more about our own faith? I say, yes, thank you. Where are you so I may kiss your hand? For having some basira and understanding. Yes, we have to learn more about our faith. Hasan. But at the same time, let me give you a story as a matter of fact. The great Allama Al-Amini, rahmatullah alayhi, recited salawat for his soul. Can I get that water? And another salawat for my water. He says that on the day of judgment, I'm going to stop those who caused Saqifa and others. I'm going to stop them. We all know who Allama Amini is, right? The one who spent 40 years of his life on one book, Al-Ghadir, 11 volumes. 40 years of your life. And the way he spent these 40 years. Right now we have people who, I hate going on a tangent, but I have no choice. We have people who sometimes will be, you know, where in cities and countries where there are houses. I say this because I'm seeing it firsthand sometimes. I've been in Najaf, I've been in Qom for 8 years. What were you doing in 8 years? Please tell me. Anyway, some, not all, a few, but they're out there. Alhamdulillah, they're out there. Representing the deen, representing the religion, wearing the libas and all that kind of stuff. Allama Amini spends 40 years, not like that, 40 years of just hard work. I don't want to get into his stories of how he wouldn't eat or sleep or drink. He would go to a library for like 3 days and not drink that much so that he wouldn't have to use the bathroom that much. Because this, he only had 3 days in this library to do his work for this book, Al-Ghadir. 11 volumes, just for Al-Ghadir. What is Al-Ghadir all about? Ghadir Khum. It's about proving the Imam of Amir al-Mu'mineen, right? So he spends 40 years to try to prove this incident and what is meant by Man Kuntum Mawla and all that kind of stuff. We know, most of us or all of us know about this. Okay, he says, I'm going to stop those people on the Day of Judgment. They're going to have to pay for all that time I spent. Because that time that I spent for this issue, I could have spent on opening up what Imamah is all about. I could have spent on getting deeper into my faith and more research in my faith. A person like Allama Tabtabai gets the opportunity to spend 20 years on Al-Mizan, which is an encyclopedia. Shahid Mutahhari says some things about this tafsir that you don't hear him say about other books. And others, they get the chance. Allama Amini says, I'm going to stop them. Yes, we're supposed to move on. But unfortunately, what do? Especially since we don't have enough English material regarding this issue. Now you might say, no, we do. I'll say we do, but not enough. Especially given the goal that we're going to, inshallah, pursue these nights, one, and the approach we're going to have, inshallah, these nights. When it comes to these two, to be honest, I don't think we have that much out there, in English especially. So let's talk about the goal a little bit and the approach. What are you talking about? The goal that we're pursuing is this. Usually, when it comes to this whole Shia Sunni thing that goes on, they want to prove that they're right, they want to prove that they're wrong, they want to make this one Shia, this one Sunni, and so on and so forth. That's the goal. What are we after? Let me explain some things first. When you look at mainstream Islam, it is represented by the Sunni majority, of course. The majority in number. They're a majority. And this shouldn't be disheartening. The Prophet, we have a hadith that, yes, be of the jama'ah. Be of the group. But which group? The majority in number? It says, jama'atu ummati ahlul haq. When I say be with the jama'ah, I mean the ahlul haq. That's my jama'ah. That's my people. Even wa in qallu, even if they're a little bit. وَإِن كَانُوا عَشَرًا, if they're 10 even. Be with that group. So we're not disheartened by that. But at the end of the day, this is what is being represented. They are representing mainstream Islam. Okay, when something's mainstream, the rest become sects. They become denominations. They become breakoffs from and offshoots from the mainstream. If we can get a salawat and move forward so that the brothers that are coming in, they have room to sit. When you have a mainstream, that means anything that's not mainstream is what? Is the one that, you know, broke off from that truth, from that solid, stable, mainstream, and widely accepted truth. Okay? Well, how do we look at the Zaydis right now? How do we look at the Ismailis right now? How do we look at the Waqifiyya? They were all, they broke off from the Ithna Ashari, you know, kind of, that kind. So now everyone's looking at us, the Shia, with all of our denominations, looking at us as someone who broke off. Why? Because there was a solid foundation called Islam, and then some people, you know, decided that they're going to do things differently, and they broke off. Okay, so what do we have? We have a stable foundation. We have stuff going smoothly throughout history. The Prophet passes away, then others take over. This is all smooth and it was all planned out. It was all planned out by the Prophet even. We'll discuss some of the hadith that we have here that are in the other sources. Everything was going perfectly well. Some people just wanted to break off. The foundations of them are shaky. Our foundations are solid. That's what they'll say. That's why we're called the sect, the Shia sect. They are mainstream. Okay. When this happens, we are likened to Christianity. How? Let me explain. When you look at the Christianity, look at the body, I'm talking about Catholicism here, the Catholic faith, you find there's a book like this thick. It's called Code, The Code of Canon Law. Go and Google it tonight. The Code of Canon Law, 1983. That's the last translation of it from Latin to English. In that book, you will find it's like the Risala Amaliya of the Catholic faith. Now, we're all thinking, oh, there is no Sharia. There is no legal system and laws and ahkam the way we have in Islam, right? When it comes to Catholicism, right? But there is a set of laws, and it's this thick, the book, where the whole hierarchy from the Pope all the way down is explained in detail. Like, it's like Risala Amaliya, issue 1, issue 2, issue 3, it all goes all the way. Burying the dead, marriage, I don't know, al-waqf. Waqf. They have that. And things like that. The church, all that kind of stuff. It's all explained there. So when you look at it, it's all coherent. It all makes sense. It's, you know, it's all clicking. Each rule clicks with the other rule. But you're saying to yourself, where did this all come from? Did Jesus tell you this? No. They will tell you, and I'm just saying this because I've done some research in it. They will tell you, no. The councils, the early councils of the church where their ulama would get together and they would try to reach an ijma', a consensus regarding an issue of faith. For example, the Trinity. For example, a redemption and all that kind of stuff. They will come to a conclusion. They will say, Jesus is inspiring this consensus. He's behind it. That's where the authority and credibility comes from. Okay. So now, for me, an outsider, of course, I will say this holds no credibility for me whatsoever, right? So it's something, it's a big building that is coherent and strong, but the foundations are weak. So the building will come down, right? That's me looking at Christianity. Now, the Shia faith, also, they will tell you, has the same issue, the same problem. It might make sense, the whole isma and the hierarchy of, you know, the prophet, the imams, and then the normal people and all that makes sense, you know. And then you have to follow those who are ma'asum and all the traditions and all the hadith and all the fiqh that comes out of it, etc. All the way till the 12th imam, it all makes sense, it's all coherent. But it's all standing on a shaky foundation. You guys broke off from that smooth and coherent transition of the Prophet passing away and power and Khilafah moving on into the first Khalifa's hands. And the Prophet wanted this, but you guys broke off. And do you know why you broke off? Because your roots are in the Jewish faith. You know, we've heard this too, right? Abdullah bin Saba. You are Sabaites. Your roots are from Abdullah bin Saba. A person who just showed up and just made up these things. That's why your foundations are weak. This is what we're gonna hear. What is our goal now? I was talking about our goal, right? Considering, taking into consideration this point, our goal is to show that no, I don't want you to be Shia. I don't care. It would be good though, but I don't care right now. My goal is to show that it wasn't as smooth as you say. If my foundations are shaky, then your foundations are also shaky. Now, you want to go this way? Fine, I'll go this way. But don't look at me like you have everything set for you, everything figured out for you. It's as clear as day. And then when it comes to me, or when it comes to us, we don't know what we're talking about. No. It's both of us have shaky foundations, let's say, quote unquote. I went this way, you went that way. This is what we're after. This is our goal. Usually, this goal is not pursued. To show that, just to prove that it was shaky. Now, we're not speaking to the Shia here. We're not even speaking to the moderate ones that are not of the Shia. We want to talk to those who don't believe in anything we believe in. in any of the sources that we believe in even. Only Bukhari and Muslim. But we have to also be aware of a problem that you will find in the Shia school, in the Shia speakers that sometimes speak about these issues. And that is, we don't want to fall into the trap of always citing Bukhari and Muslim and the Sahihain and thinking that it's over. Alhamdulillah, we found a hadith for this. And since you, Ahlul Sunnah, you believe in Sahihain and you believe in the book of Al-Bukhari to be Asahu Kitabin Ba'da Kitabillah, the most authentic and the most reliable book after the Quran, that doesn't mean, brothers and sisters, that necessarily if there's a hadith in there, we can use it. Why don't we see what they have to say? If you want to be weak, then yeah, go by your own rules. Play the game the way you want to play it. But if you want to be effective and be efficient, see what they have to say. Now, of course, this will require tolerance from our Shia brothers and sisters when we're talking about these issues. There have been times when I was researching these things that I wanted to bash my head against the wall. Oh my God, all my life I've been hearing this hadith, that we have this hadith. For example, Fatimah Zahra died while she was angry with the two khalifas, right? And this is in Bukhari. But did you know they have answers for this? Let's try to figure out which ones they accept, which ones they have answers for, and try to counter the answers. I've seen lecturers talk like this, and it shows our weakness, kind of. There is a hadith in Bukhari, so now what do you have to say? Now we have proven you're wrong, now we've knocked your teeth out, and so on and so forth. What kind of rhetoric is that, first of all? Second of all, they have the same thing against us. Yes, we have a hadith. You want me to cite some for you, inshallah, future nights, if we get the chance, in Al-Kafi, that they cite against us. The Imam Sadiq, for example, they came to him, they asked him about the first two. He said, tawallihima, have them as your imam. Of course, the Shia knows why the imam says it like this. Yes? And there's some heavy taqiyya involved here. And the end of the hadith shows that there was taqiyya. But anyway, they use the same thing against us. How come when it comes to us, we say, oh, it's not fair. Just because there's a hadith here doesn't mean we accept it. We have explanations for these hadith. How come we can say this, but then they can't say this? They'll say the same thing. So when we're discussing these issues, we have to understand that they will have answers. So we want to see what their version of the stories are. Which stories is their version closer to our version? Which stories are their versions far away from us? At least know what's going on if we're going to have an effective impact. And this has happened. Regarding Fatimah Zahra and her anger of the two khalifas, that I'll explain inshallah in depth in future nights. A sister who was Sunni, who was attending some lectures somewhere, she came and she said, we also have another hadith. She was being convinced by this argument, apparently. But then she comes and she says, but then I was informed by other Sunni sheikhs, that we also have hadith that Fatimah al-Zahra was happy with them. They were able to convince her and make her happy. Yeah. So I'm not going to come and say, oh, I have a hadith, I found that it's over, done, game over. No, it's not going to work like that, because there's other hadith. There's hadith about everything. And it's not just Sunnis who struggle from this. Even the Shia school struggles with this. Well, we have such a problem, brothers and sisters, with the hadith that we have in our sources, unfortunately, about how the Quran was changed and so on. Our muhaqqiqeen, our researchers, our great ulama, they're fighting this. Ayatollah Khoui, Imam Khomeini, they've spoken out against this when Al-Akhund Al-Khurasani in Kifayat Al-Usul, he shows some leniency towards the Quran not being the same Quran. This is a great scholar, Akhund Al-Khurasani. His books are still studied till today in the Hawza. Advanced, super advanced. If a person can understand two pages of Kifaya, they will feel a pleasure from the head to toe. It's so hard to understand this book. Very deep. He says, he shows some inclination right away. You see, Ayatollah Khoi, he has a commentary, an annotation there. Imam Khomeini has things to say there. And everyone else has things to say there. They're fighting this. But we have the hadith. Hadith, we have to understand how hadith were back then. A person would feel good about something, says Qal al-Sadiq. Sometimes it becomes like that. Now, at the same time, we have to be careful not to fall on the other side. Oh, I don't accept any hadith. Who are you? Assalamu alaikum, who are you? We have this problem on the other side as well. That's why we go to our ulama for these things. Point being, brothers and sisters, we want to be effective. We don't want it to backfire on us. So what are we going to do? We're going to try to go as tolerating as possible and see how far we can get with these, with this ideology and with this understanding. A good example of that, right, is what they've done with Al-Ghadir, okay? That same problem we will have in all of these dark days and these days of darkness of Fatimiyya, each and every one of them. Let me give you a little bit of an inside info where we're going to have future nights. We're going to be talking about Raziyat Yawm Al-Khamis, the Black Thursday. What is that black, dark, tragic Thursday? What happened? What's that version, their version? What's our version? Let's go back and forth a little bit. Understand what's going on. What happens after that? The army of Usama. Did the Prophet really curse those who stayed back and didn't go in this army? Didn't partake in that war or no? What can we get out of it? What's their version? What's our version? What's their answer to us? What's our answer to them? Yes. On the minbar, usually you will hear this, that La'anallah al-mutkhallifin an jaysh Usama, the Prophet cursed the ones who stayed back from this army. And this is hadith, so you should accept. No, they have answers. Let's see what the answers are. And let's see if we can counter those answers. The last prayer of the Prophet is very important. That's another thing we'll talk about. One by one, these things, and then after, Saqifa, their version, our version, back and forth. I don't know if we'll get enough time to cover all these. Inshallah, we will. And so on and so forth. You will see that with each and every one of these incidents, they have dealt with it the same way they dealt with Ghadir. Yes. It doesn't matter if it's in the Musnad of Ibn Hanbal. It doesn't matter if it's in the Mustadrak of An-Naysaburi. It doesn't matter. They say, oh, here it's not in the Sahihain, so we can't accept it. Ghadir is not in the Sahihain. So what I want to do, inshallah, in these nights is see what their way out is. Now, someone might say, why do they even want to go out? Why would someone want to not give in to the truth when it's there? The answer is, for them, it hasn't been proven that it's the truth. Why? Because of those foundational principles. And I'm not even going to say principles. I'm going to say foundational principle. One. Brothers and sisters, our problem is one foundational principle that has given a lens to these to others. They will see everything through this lens. Everything. What is that principle? Adalat al-Sahaba. If someone asks, what's wrong? You will tell them, this is what's wrong. Everything that happens is under the shadow, under the umbrella of this foundational and overriding principle of the righteousness of the companions of the Prophet. That a companion of the Prophet equals as if practically ma'sum. Practically. They won't say it theoretically. But practically you will see that, whoa, this is just like our imams, man. We just have like 12, but for that there's like 100,000 ma'sums. In practice though. They'll say he's not ma'sum. To the extent that Amr bin Hamiq al-Khuza'i is killing Uthman, they will say, he's our Sayyid, and the one that's being killed is our Sayyid. Ijtahada fa'akhta. This one thought he has to do it, he's rewarded. That one died in the way of Allah, he's rewarded. Imam Ali Muawiyah, they're fighting each other. One has to be right, one has to be wrong. No. One is closer to the truth, one is farther away from the truth. What kind of talking is this? They're fighting each other. They're killing each other. Yeah, but you don't know. that in the night, in the Battle of Siffin, they would go and meet each other. Assalamu alaikum, assalamu alaikum. Yeah, you were fighting good today. I'll see you tomorrow. Is that how it works? No. But it's something that doesn't, the fitrah can't accept. The fitrah can't understand. But no, it's been established firmly. Now this, Adalat al-Sahaba, is something that requires a topic itself. And we're not even going to get close to that. We're not going to talk about that at all. And our great ulama have written books on this. And even some of the Salafis, some, very few, are even against it. Salafi. And they've written books on it. But that's a whole other topic. But the question of why would someone do such a thing? This is why. These foundational principles. You want an example? I'll give you a good example. Yadullahi fawqa aydihim. Allah's hand is on their hands, is over their hands. When? When they're giving bay'ah to the Prophet. Bay'ah to shajara. Yes? Or ar-ridwan. What happens is, you know, the whole story of Fath Mecca and the year before it and all that, how the Prophet wanted to do Umrah and all that kind of stuff, the mushrikeen didn't let him in and so on. That's a long story, whatever. But we're talking about the verse that says Allah's hand is on their hand. Okay, now I was in Mecca this year, Medina, Mecca, and I was discussing with the Wahhabi, I've said this before elsewhere too, discussing with the Wahhabi, the ones that guard, you know, the baqiyah, to make sure that you don't go to hell because you said salams to the imams. And discussing stuff, one of the things we discussed was this. I said, okay, so like, I don't know how the conversation got here. He was like, I was like, okay, hand of God, what does that mean? He said, well, it means God has a hand. I was like, dude, God has a hand. He said, yes, God has a hand. Why? The Quran said so. Whoa, you mean there's no metaphoricalness, you know, whatever that I just made up a word, metaphoricalness. There's none of that kind of stuff, figurative speech in the Quran, nothing? When Allah says, my hand is on their hand. Yes, he has a hand, he said. But it's not like our hands. Thank you very much. No, please say that his hand looks just like our hands. But for the normal approach, and it's not just the Shia, even like, for example, Fakhr al-Razi or the Mu'tazilites, they have the same understanding. They don't have that literalist approach. What do they say? They say, listen, we have a foundational principle that says Allah is not material. He can't be. The second you say He's material, you have stripped Him of His uluhiyyah and His lordship. We have this principle. It's an aqli principle even. Sometimes your principle comes from here. Sometimes it comes from the Quran. This one happens to be one that comes from here. If a verse goes against a well-established principle, I will reinterpret the verse. When it says Allah's hand is on their hand, I will say, this means Allah is doing ta'yid of them. Allah is with them. Allah is supporting them. Yeah? Or will I just, you know, put aside that principle that's established and say, no, this means hand, physical hand. No, it's the other way around. Here also, you will have this foundational principle of adalat al-sahaba. When this happens, everything is seen in light of this principle. Yes, recite salawat, please. There's another example I want to give, but I won't because I don't want to go over my time. So brothers and sisters, to wrap it up, these days were dark days, full of darkness. What makes it even darker is the fact that it is questioned. Unlike Ashura. Ashura is established. They kept it alive. The imams know. Keep this in mind. Take this away from this lecture, brothers and sisters. The imams know that if Ashura is not kept alive with emotions and tears, a day will come that even Ashura will be denied. Imam Hussein died because he got ill. He fell ill. Imam Hussein, even till today, they're saying that 4,000 people only came to Ashura, to Karbala, to fight the imam. They will take the least number. Everything minimalistic. Everything at a minimum. The imams know that if they let this go, then that only torch that is left to save Tawheed will be extinguished. Fatimiyya kind of suffered from this. Now, why the Imams didn't do the same there, there's a long story behind it. Their haqq and batil still wasn't divided the way it was on Ashura. They couldn't keep it alive that way. That's why the enemy got to work. And all of it was covered up. So when we're talking about these things over these nights and the different versions of these stories, brothers and sisters, this should help us understand the extent of the mazlumiyya of Fatimah al-Zahra. These should help us weep more, inshallah, for Fatimah al-Zahra. We ask Allah to give us that tawfiq so that we can weep for our mother, and also the tawfiq to gain an education regarding these issues so that we have answers also, and so that we can grow more confident in our cause. Inshallah, we're going to continue with the masail of Fatimah al-Zahra alayhi salam. Inshallah, recite three loud. Salawat ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.